I remember vividly that on December 7th, 1941, Nellie came and she said, where is Pearl Harbor? And no one knew. And someone said, why? I said, well, the Japs have bombed it. I said, well, it's just Orson Welles on a radio program or something.
But how about the unimportant days? Meaning the days that were important but only to you. Like the day you got the first dent in the first car you bought after the war. Now, that was a day. Or does it just seem that way in retrospect? This is Henry Morgan. Group W, the Westinghouse Broadcasting Company, presents That Other Generation. A lighthearted look at that time in American history we call the 40s. You will hear from many people who lived through the war effort, the dawn of the atomic era, and the hectic time that followed. And reflecting on the formative, frantic decade of the 1940s is our host, Mr. Henry Morgan. Tonight's show, A Day in the Life During the 1940s. If you add up one separate day in the lives of a whole lot of people, would you get a picture of their decade? Take the day you joined the army, the day you got married, the day you got a really good job, or didn't get one. Together, they all add up to your life. Here's one. How about the first time you saw New York City after escaping from Czechoslovakia in 1939 by way of France and Portugal? This is a day in the life of George Asher, who's still living in New York City.
The reception, at least as far as I was concerned, was, I don't want to exaggerate, it was, we could really say it was touching. There was the immigration office, and we were all quite nervous. I had one of these danger visa, which I got through Mrs. Roosevelt's action, with 2,000 people who got these visa, and I had this visa on my passport, and naturally, after all these experiences, you were not exactly calm, and I was quite a little bit nervous, and the immigration officer was on the boat, and he looked at my passport, and he glanced at me, and he said one or two words, and he said, take it easy. And that was for me, and I will never forget in my life. I didn't want to be sentimental, but it was fantastic. That was the first uniformed man in any place, in any country, and I've been chased through several ones, that would welcome or express himself in this way.
Hip, hip, hooray. We're living in the USA. Come on, you Yanks, all holler thanks. Hip, hooray. Hip, hip, hooray.
A lot of other people were arriving on our shores about that time, or perhaps being evacuated to here, like the English youngsters that were sent over here for safekeeping. A lady from Georgia recalls a day in the life of her town before the war.
It was about 1940, and America's Georgia was the first place where the British cadets, when they first came to this country, they came to America's. America's became very, very British suddenly. Such fun. We suddenly had tea every afternoon around 4 o'clock, if anyone were entertaining a British cadet, and the whole town just opened their arms to the cadets. Funny thing about the cadets, they were so formal. They always wore their coats in that hot climate. Not only did we try to act in the way that we thought the British would like by having tea, but we also became very Southern and to show them what Southern hospitality was. Then, of course, out at the field, they would have wonderful dances, and that was a lot of fun. And when the United States went into the war, the American cadets came in and the British were sent home.
Come on and sing. Hip, hooray. Hip, 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 hooray.
Other days reflect quaint customs and prices that no longer exist. There was a day in 1940 when a Pan Am Clipper flew from New York to Lisbon in a mere 18 and a half hours. Here's a day in pre-war New York recalled by a then high school boy.
Martin Block in the make-believe ballroom. I guess most kids grew up on that, because it seemed to me it was on 28 hours a day. And if you turned on, what was it, WNEW? Whatever the station was, you could get dance music with the big bands.
As I came up the top of the hatchway, why it was 5 minutes till eight, there was a plane came across our close to our fantail and dropped very low in the water. And we were all stood there in amazement, not knowing what to do. We realized it was a Japanese plane, but we just were stunned and dumbfounded and just actually stood there and watched this torpedo go through the water and hit his target on the other side, which as a matter of fact was USS Oklahoma.
We heard this boom, boom, and it sounded like fireworks. So we got up topside and we saw these ships were turning over like corks in the water. And within a short time, the beautiful bay of Pearl Harbor was totally cast with black oil.
Hey, hey, what are we going to do? Hey, hey, it's up to me and you. Hey, hey, here's something to think over twice. If we don't get busy and win this war, we'll all be living on rice.
I remember, as most of us who went through it would, the day I enlisted. I went down here in New York City to a place which really no longer exists. It was a place called Grand Central Palace. And I was very much excited and thrilled. I was against war, I suppose, in the way everybody's against war. But at that time, we bought it because we knew it was necessary. And even thoughtful people like me were, while not terribly eager, pretty eager to get in. Then we all took the oath, all 40 of us in this particular group, felt like heroes in a way, until a sergeant said, "All right, now you never some of us all go out from the door on the left and down the office out of front. Hi there, hop, hop." Half the glory was over.
Hey, hey, pull up our belts and grunt. Hey, hey, it's work and not talk we want. Hey, hey, we've all been asleep at the switch, and now we've got more scratching to do than a guy with a 7-year itch.
About 15 million guys managed to survive some form of basic training during the war. The military scooped up a very mixed bag of personnel, including actors, writers, cartoonists, and even humorists. Remember See Here, Private Hargrove? A day in the life of that Private Hargrove is recalled by his Army buddy Ralph Stein. Both were on the staff of Yank magazine.
Spence got the idea of sending Hargrove and me out on a trip to camp, figuring Hargrove could write funny stuff and then I would illustrate it. I remember sitting in the Union Pacific tracks with him in Fort Riley, Kansas. We were going to get fired in a minute if we didn't, you know. By being fired didn't mean you were thrown out of the Army. It meant they'd throw you into the infantry or something. And there was Hargrove sitting near the Union Pacific tracks at Fort Riley with horseshoe nails he'd gotten, because this was still horse cavalry in Fort Riley. With horseshoe nails, he'd cross and put on the tracks and wait for trains to cross them, and they'd make little pairs of scissors, you know, like kids do. There were these two sergeants sitting at the side of the track.
Hey, hey, we've all got a duty to do. Hey, hey, labor and capital too. Hey, hey, there'll be no profit and loss, and there'll be no 5 o'clock whistle to blow if we work for a Nazi boss.
That number we kept bringing back is something called Plain Talk, written and sung by one Carson J. Robeson. Remember a day during the war when you went out into the bean fields to help the farmers and couldn't straighten up for a week? Remember a day when you were told by your draft board that you were too old? Or worse, too young? Remember the days you gave blood? Remember days you spent glued to the radio waiting for news? Remember a day that brought a telegram from the War Department? Even kids, or perhaps I should say especially kids, have special wartime memories.
Oh, I remember right after we got into the war. And this is very, psychologically very disturbing to a 12-year-old kid. We wore plastic ID dog tags with our names and dates of birth and an ID number. And once we had those, we were sure that we were... going to be disintegrated, and that was the only thing that was going to be left in the rubble. It was kind of upsetting. I remember we had air raid drills, yeah. Friends have told me they had a dive under their desks. We were not quite as hysterical, but we did have to get out into the school corridor and crouch in what has since come to be known as gook fashion. You know, we called it... We did duck walking, I remember.
The tall man with the high hat will be coming down your way. Get your savings out when you hear him shout. Any bonds today? Any bonds today? Bonds of freedom, that's what I'm selling. Any bonds today? Scrape up the most you can. Here comes the freedom man, asking you to buy a share of freedom today.
A typical war bond rally that I remember was held in a grammar school, and you had entertainment by the local band. You had singing of patriotic songs. You had speeches by the local block warden. In those days, it was civil defense, and they wore their white helmets. Usually, some notable from the entertainment field who was in town would lend their name to a war bond rally. And they were filled with the great, exciting drama that enmeshes a people when they're all for one and one for all, for survival.
And the sirens went off one night, and the lights started to go out, and the radio announced that there was an unidentified plane over the Atlantic coming to New York. So the first thing we did was run up on the roof. We were standing there, and the spotlights went on over the city, down over the river, and Central Park, and downtown. And we were standing there and identifying, and all of a sudden we realized that all of the rooftops were covered with people. Everybody had come up on the roof to see the air raid. It was about to take place. And it turned out to be a B-17 that was flying to England, and it turned around. It sounds strange, but all of the kids had a knowledge of the machinery that was involved, and we knew that there was nothing that could possibly bomb New York. And it was a funny thing. We knew that the blackouts were called and the sirens went off to let convoys out.
After we had sat up all night on buses and trains and clung to our men until the last possible minute, when we were women alone, we would all get together and play bridge for endless, endless days.
This rather courageous little girl is Rhoda Riddell.
And we also, many of us, worked at the USO, and often on Thanksgiving and Christmas would invite other servicemen, hoping that our husbands, wherever they were being invited into some home and weren't alone. When we entertained, this was something so complicated to find all of the foods and to stretch the ration tickets. Also, we learned to buy horse meat and discovered that marinating it in oil and garlic gave it quite a good flavor. And we often didn't say anything, but would serve it without a word and let people enjoy the fillet that they thought they were having.
Anybody who endured days in Washington, D.C. during the war will never forget them, like Mr. A.A. Burley, Jr.
It was a strange madhouse, oddly enough, with all its inconveniences, a rather pleasant one. You would go down to your office. I had gasoline for a car because I was Assistant Secretary of State. You would stop at the nearest apartment house where were multitudes of people hoping a stray bus would come their way. You'd take in everybody that could pile into or on top of the car and take them down to Pennsylvania Avenue or somewhere near where they were going. And you'd repeat the process on the way back. But during that period, every kind of question came up. You would have three declarations of war in your in-basket. Put them at the bottom of the pile because they weren't really important. These were just satellites that had been raked in by the German armies and didn't make much difference whether they declared war or whether they didn't. This kind of thing went on. It was a fantastic experience. It wasn't gay. The big dinner parties that you think of as going with Washington today, of course, aren't good form in wartime Washington. So that what actually happened was that it was played in a very low key.
Know that I'm in a state of elation. Something's cooking that rates an ovation. Call the press in, I got a quotation. Tell the nation, my guys come back no more.
VJ Day was sometime in August. Steve was born in September. Rowley was working at Hazeltine Electronics at the time, and they gave him 45 minutes notice on the PA system that he was finished. At 4 o'clock, when you leave, turn in your tools, you're through.
Oh, really?
And when he came home that night and told me that he didn't have a job and a baby due in about 6 weeks, it was a little bit rough, because on wartime salaries, you couldn't afford...
That's another thing. On the wartime salary I got at the electronics plant, it was just about enough to pay for food and rent. All the savings were used up by the time the war was over and I got fired.
My name is James Torpy. I started the work for the New York Times in 1928 when we installed the electric sign in Times Square, New York. I was called into the sign room at 4:30 a.m. in the morning, and at that time, there was thousands in Times Square waiting for some news. When the sign went on, we flashed, it would continue to operate all day and all night. I put in 23 and a half hours waiting for the news that came. 3 minutes after the announcement by President Truman, you never heard anything like it in your life. There were never a bigger crowd in any square in any part of the world. The yells went up. Everybody went crazy. Everybody went mad, hollering and screaming, horns blowing. And the police at that time estimated that in the Times Square area, between the square and the side streets and the hotels, there was in the neighborhood of 2 million people packing into Times Square. The subways were blocked. There was nothing they could do to handle the crowd. Everybody went just absolutely mad.
Blue sky, smiling at me now. All I can see now is blue sky for me from now on.
Blue sky. Anyone remember the weather in the 1940s? Let me put it another way. Remember the blizzard on Washington's birthday, 1948? Remember the summer of 1949? All summers were hot in those days because there wasn't any air conditioning. To give you an idea of a really hot day, listen to sports writer Hal Rosenthal.
Air conditioning was a thing of the future in the late 40s. So that the ball players and all people in sports had to put up with the humidity just like everybody else. And I remember going into St. Louis with a Dodger club, or maybe it was a Giant club, in mid summer, and you could truly say you could fry an egg on the sidewalk in front of the Hotel Chase, because I saw a man do it. And my room would be airless because all the windows were shut. See, the first thing I'd do would be to run to the windows and throw them wide open. And the second thing I'd do would be to shut them immediately because the blast that would come in almost fried me. And I remember some of the ball players, the tricks they used to go to bed in the terrible heat in the Midwest. They'd come back. See, everything was daytime ball. They'd come back from the ballpark. It would be 5, 6 o'clock, and they'd manage to eat in this 105-degree dining room, and they'd go up to their room, and they'd take the sheets off the bed, and they'd soak them in the bathtub, and then they'd lie down on the mattress and with the wet sheet wrapped around them, and the fan, you know, one of these revolving fans. The idea, too, was to help yourself fall asleep, so they would get a couple of cold beers, and they would lie there in these wet sheets on this damp mattress with a fan blowing on them, and they'd slowly sip the beer. And the idea is, by the time you had the second beer finished, you were supposed to be asleep. If you didn't, you were in trouble.
How well I remember another day in the late 40s. The day the television set was delivered. The first TV. Mine actually had a 1-inch screen. Bernie Pinsker recalls like it was yesterday.
One of my best friends, his father, did very well, and they bought a television set. Oh, and I was there when the set came with my friend, and we watched as the man installed. Such an excitement. And he being my best friend, luckily for me, because I couldn't, we couldn't afford a TV set when it came out. And I was there, my friend told me when it was coming or something, the day it was coming, and my friend and I stood there and waited for the man to come, and the man came in the truck, and it took him a long time to set it up. Obviously it wasn't that long, but we were so excited. And sure enough, the first thing I ever saw on a home TV set was the Cardinals and the Dodgers at Ebbets Field. And it was such a thrill to see, a baseball game in my friend's living room. It really was a thrill. I'll never forget it. Mort Cooper was pitching for the Cardinals at the time, and I just stood there in disbelief. And then, as soon as the TV man left, the set didn't hold, and it started to drift, and things everything you can think of happened, and we ended up adjusting it where, for some reason, everything was in the back.
That's Glenn Miller's band with the Missouri Waltz. I remember the day, or rather the night, that Harry Truman was reelected. That was a cliffhanger. Remember who his vice president was? Senator Alvin Barkley, the Veep. Of course, I wasn't directly involved in politics, but Mr. Jonathan Daniels, who publishes the Raleigh Observer, accompanied the president during the campaign, and he remembers Election Day 1948 this way.
I went home just before Election Day to my job as editor of a Democratic newspaper in the South. And we'd always had the custom, begun long ago by my father, that when there was a Democratic victory, we would overprint a red rooster on the front page. Well, when I told the boys to get out that overprint, they laughed at me pretty heartily. They said, "We'll never need that tonight." But, see, about 6 o'clock in the morning, Truman called me from Kansas City and said, "Jonathan, we're in." And he was, but strangely enough, I'd come to New York the next day. And I was flying over Richmond at noon before Dewey conceded the election. And then I came into the Roosevelt Hotel, which had been the Dewey headquarters. And all of the reporters and politicians were coming out of their rooms like bugs out of the woodwork. And it was a great day for me, as I guess among some of the politicians there, maybe I was a bastard at a family reunion, but I never enjoyed a party so much.
Listen now to a day in the life of the President of the United States. Not a typical day, but a day of awesome responsibility. It was June 25th, 1950.
I was in Independence, Missouri in June 1950 when Secretary Atchison telephoned me and gave me the news about the invasion of Korea. I told the secretary to lay the matter once before the United Nations, and I came on back to Washington. Flying back over the flatlands of the Middle West and over the Appalachians that summer afternoon, I had a lot of time to think. But my thoughts kept coming back to the 1930s, to Manchuria, to Ethiopia, the Rhineland, Austria, and finally, Munich. Here was history repeating itself. Here was another probing action, another testing action. If we let the Republic of Korea go under, some other country would be next, and then another. And all the time, the courage and confidence of the free world would be ebbing away, just as it did in the 1930s. And the United Nations would go the way of the League of Nations. When I reached Washington, I met immediately with the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, and General Bradley, and the other civilian and military officials who had information and advice to help me decide on what to do. It was not easy to make the decision to send American boys again into battle. We realized that the issue was whether there would be fighting in a limited area now or on a much larger scale later on, whether there would be some casualties now or many more casualties later. So a decision was reached. The decision, I believe, was the most important in my time as President of the United States.
The Korean War lasted 1,127 days after that. But that's another story. This is Henry Morgan. Group W, the Westinghouse Broadcasting Company, has presented That Other Generation. A nostalgic look at the 1940s in 13 chapters with the people who lived through them. Your host has been Henry Morgan. The series is written and produced by Joan and Robert Franklin. Executive producer, William Kaland. Now here again is Henry Morgan to tell you about next week's show. As the 1940s began, some 90 miles of coaxial cable and 9 miles of telephone line allowed New York viewers to see the Republican convention in Philadelphia. As the decade closed, the coaxial cable went from coast to coast. But in between, there was radio.
You know, it was never, never land. Ma Perkins still had her problems with the lumber yard, but you'd never have known there was a war going on. Joan Blaine was being a valiant lady, but you never knew there was a war going on. Of course, you know, it was good escapism.
Somehow, we managed to pack something for everyone into Frequencies of the 40s, which is next week's show. If you're listening to radio right now, you won't want to miss it.